Liam Teague on KUAC's Alaska Live performing Steel Pan. Ooh, that was really gorgeous. And
thank you.
I guess I'd almost describe it as tender, you know, because sometimes we think of the Steel Pan as just this raucous, you know, carnival. Mm-hmm. But that composition just had almost like a lullaby. It was just very nice.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, a lot of people around the world are really not familiar with the steel pan's potential. And this is, as I mentioned earlier, it's the national instrument of Trinidad and Tobago. And the pioneers of these instruments always wanted to highlight their versatility, profundity, and musicality. And I try to hold true to that tradition by not only playing calypso music, which is also from Trinidad and which I absolutely love, but playing in a variety of styles, so be it classical music, jazz, ragtime, you name it, I try to do it to really highlight, you know, the various musical possibilities of this instrument.
Prior to this interview, I've trained myself to call it the steel pan versus the steel drum,
yes.
But I'm not sure why, but I know why I've done it, because when I was doing my research, it was always referred to as a steel pan as far as, you know, your work is concerned.
Yes.
So tell us about that, Liam.
Well, outside of the Caribbean, most people refer to the instrument as the steel drum. But really, in Trinidad and Tobago and elsewhere in the Caribbean, the instrument is called the steel pan or pan. You know, and since that's where the instrument is from, I think that's the correct terminology. However, many times, you know, you say steel pan to a non-Trinidadian, you know, what have you, they'll say, what? You know, so many times people will call it the steel drum.
Yeah.
It's actually called steel pan or pan.
Because it's originally, I don't know if they still are, but originally they're made from drums cut in varying lengths.
Yes, most of them still today are made from 55-gallon oil drums, you know, and it's...
Yeah.
It's a process that takes many, many years to learn how to do, you know, and I don't have that skill, so I just play them.
You let somebody else make them and tune
exactly.
them. That sounds, well, that's common with just about any instrument, you
right.
know. Not a lot of guitarists out there are luthiers also, you know, making their own guitars. There are
yes.
some, but the majority of them are enjoying what somebody else has made.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was by that first composition mm-hmm. that you shared was by somebody from Trinidad.
Yes, he's no longer alive, but he was considered to be the grandmaster of the calypso art form.
Lord Kitchener.
Lord Kitchener. His real name was Aldwin Roberts, you know. And one of the things that he was particularly noted for was composing music that paid homage to the steel pan. So that first piece I played was called Pan Night and Day.
Pan Night and Day.
Yes.
You were invited here to Fairbanks to work with both the West Valley group and our local groups, Cold Steel.
Cold Steel, yes.
And they've been going for quite some time in Fairbanks. We've had a presence of players and people interested in enjoying steel pan, right?
Yes, yes.
And this is not your first trip to Fairbanks.
This is my second trip. I was here, I believe, in 2006 for the... PAS Alaska Day of Percussion, you know, and I'm really excited to be back. You know, when I tell people, you know, emailing them and telling them I'm in Alaska, they can't believe that, you know. It's the last place you expect to hear the steel pan, you know, and I'm so happy that this instrument has, you know, it's really been going around the world and people are accepting it as a legitimate musical instrument.
I know when Morris Palter, the UAF percussion professor, came down, you know, he just wanted to check in with you because, I mean, you're a big deal in the percussion world.
Well, at least that's what my mom used to tell me. So I believe her.
Right. I think on your website and in our promo, we referred to you as the Paganini of Steel Pan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Many years ago, I did a concert in Woodstock, New York, and in the review, the reviewer said, you know, for him, he was sort of a jaded music listener, you know, and that's until he heard the Paganini of the steel pan, you know, so I sort of adopted that moniker, and, you know, most times it works for me,
yeah.
But it's a lot of pressure I put on myself.
Just recently, we had Rachel Barton Pine. She's a violinist, and she came in and did the Paganini Caprices.
Yes.
And so we've had a lot of Paganini this spring, and it's fast music. Is there some Paganini pieces that you love to play with the steel pan?
Oh, definitely. And it's interesting that you mentioned Rachel, because I just reached out to her because one of my former professors at NIU, Dr. Jan Bach, he wrote a piece for steel pan and violin. So Rachel, if you're listening, I'm very interested in working with you. But I'm actually a former violinist myself. I played for about 9 years, so I've adapted a lot of violin repertoire onto the steel pan. And one of the pieces I play is Paganini's Moto Perpetuo. So if you'd like, I could just give you a short.
That would be great. Yeah, sure. Please. Liam Teague here at the KUAC studios performing Moto Perpetuo.
Short excerpt of that.
How is it possible that your hands move that fast?
That's the number one question people ask me.
After a performance like that, I would believe it.
Thank you.
It's a lot of practice.
Yes, definitely. And I usually say to the people, well, in Trinidad, when I was about 18 years old, I created a piece called Hands Like Lightning. And it actually had nothing to do with me. It had to do with steel pan musicians that performed at the major competition for steel bands called Panorama. So it was paying homage to them.
Yay.
But I made a video of that piece, and they played it in Trinidad all the time. So that moniker, that stuck with me. So now that's, as I mentioned before, that's the number one question that people ask me. How do you play so fast? And while it's nice, to have some technique, it's not what I'm about, as an artist. So I try to show, more to my playing, but people are fixated with that. But for the young people listening today, it's about practicing a lot and being very smart about your practicing. It's not necessarily how many hours you put in, although that's important, but what type of practice you do and what sort of game plan you have when you go into the practice room. So I highly encourage the young people coming up to have a plan, and stick to it.
I think Paganini prided himself in composing things that were near impossible.
Correct. Yes. And when I was growing up, my father had me listen to a lot of classical music. And I remember reading about Paganini and also Franz Liszt, the two top virtuosi of their time.
And they were known kind of as the rock stars of their time,
exactly.
If there were a moniker for that. Yeah.
And I remember my dad saying, he wanted me to actually go on stage with long gloves on and a long scissor steel tuxedo, very flamboyant and everything. And he wanted to come up on stage and take the gloves off before I played. And thank God that never worked out.
So that never happened. That was just in the dream stage.
Yes. And it stayed that way.
Good. Do you travel back to Trinidad quite a bit?
I would say about 2 times a year, and mainly for the major competition, as I mentioned before, for steel bands, which is called Panorama. It's sort of the Super Bowl of competitions. And this happens around Carnival time in February, sometimes early March. And in one band, in the large band category, you can find as many as 125 players. And they play an 8-minute arrangement of a calypso of choice, and I've been very blessed to to arrange for different steel bands in Trinidad. And right now I'm working with the Silver Stars Steel Orchestra, a very, very successful steel band in Trinidad. So I'm very glad that they asked me to work with them.
Arranging for 120 players.
Yes.
And one player can have more than one steel pan in front of them.
Correct. The particular instrument that I'm playing today is called the tenor pan in Trinidad and Tobago. It's actually in the soprano range, but for historical reasons, it's been referred to as the tenor pan. And then they become lower in range, and the basic principle is the lower the sound, the more room you need, so the notes are bigger. So as a result, you need more drums to cover the full range of the instrument. So for example, the double second instruments, which are in the alto range, you would have two drums, and then your cellos, three drums, and then finally the basses, which are the instruments people tend to have the most fun playing because they get to move around and dance and have a great old time. You know, those are, you know, at least four, sometimes six, sometimes 12 drums. You know?
And when we talk about the bass steel pan, mm-hmm. it's made of the majority of the steel drum.
That's correct.
And
that's
so
correct.
It's full length.
Correct.
And just like in any other instrument, you know, you think about violin being smaller and in the upper range, mm-hmm. and a double bass being the lowest of the strings.
Definitely.
In the lower range, and one is very much easier to carry around than the other one.
Definitely. That's why I don't travel with bass pans.
The airlines, they would probably do it for a price.
Oh, for sure.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, I know that for sure.
And so at these competitions, when we talk about how many steel pan instruments there are on the mm-hmm. stage, do all the competition participants use the same instruments then?
No.
You of know, course
each,
not.
Each band has their own instruments.
Of
and,
course.
And with steel pans, they're not totally standardized. So, you know, whereas you can go anywhere in the world and play a piano or violin, the notes are in the same place, the strings are in the same place. With steel pans, it's not always standardized. So the instrument I play, the way that the notes are laid out, they're laid out in intervals of thirds and fourths, which is an older style, but it's what I learned when I was a youngster. But most people don't play that style. So I'm always terrified when I travel if the airlines, you know, misplace my instrument or something like that, you know.
Because the notes mm-hmm. would be in a different place.
Correct.
On a more modern
yes.
steel pan.
Correct. So most of the tenor pans or the soprano pans, they're laid out in intervals of fourths and fifths, you know, which I play as well, but I don't have that much experience on them, so it would be really tough for me to try and navigate around those.
Liam, can you step up to your tenor steel pan for just a moment and just explain a little bit about what you're talking about hitting it? I know it's radio, and so
sure.
we're talking about, you know, the surface, the concave surface of the steel
yes.
pan.
Yes. So in the early days of the steel pan, the instruments didn't sound as refined as they do today. So when you listen to many early recordings, you would just hear the fundamental note, the main note. And so many pan players would play, you know, children's songs. So something like Mary Had a Little Lamb would sound like. But then the 1950s, Bertie Marshall, one of the great steel pan tuners and builders, generally credited for being the first person to experiment with harmonics, placing harmonics on the instrument. He really experimented with this sort of approach. And that's why today they sound very, very rich, you know, and so the differences. And again, in the early days, they were mainly diatonic instruments. So the repertoire possibilities were not as varied. And steel pan builders and tuners experimented, and now the instruments are totally chromatic. So a chromatic scale would sound like one octave, the octave above, and then you have a minor third. So as a result of having that, you can play, you know, more repertoire. So whether it's jazz, for example, Charlie Parker's Donna Lee, Fiocco's Allegro, Vivaldi, The Four Seasons, Winter from the Four Seasons, or a ragtime piece by George Hamilton Green. You know, it's really all possible on these instruments.
And on the one that you have right there with you that you were able to fly around the world, it has, since You explained the smaller instruments, the shorter ones, have a wider range.
Well, all of them are actually fully chromatic.
Okay.
You know, but this one is the highest range. So you could think about it like the violin within the context of a symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
Playing a similar role.
And speaking of orchestras, you have performed with an orchestra. And that is that something new to the steel pan to be the soloist with a symphony and have be, you know, instead of the pianist sitting down and being the soloist for the Rachmaninoff, it's a steel panist at up front as a soloist.
I would say I'm one of the steel pan players in the world that's doing it on a fairly regular basis. This was always a dream of mine. From around 11 years old when I started playing, my father would always play classical music to me, you know, have me listen to the BBC radio station. And some of my first musical heroes were actually not steel pan players initially.
And you said you started on violin.
I actually took up the violin shortly after the steel
pan. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So violinists like Yasha Heifetz, Itzhak Perlman, I was listening to them. And I would always imagine myself as a steel pan soloist with symphony orchestras. So from 1994, I was very, very blessed to have a piece written for me by Jan Bach, former Northern Illinois University professor. He wrote a steel pan concerto for me. And this has been the main piece that I've traveled with and performed with many orchestras around the world, St. Louis Symphony, Taiwan National Symphony. And I'm actually preparing right now for a big premiere by the composer Andy Akiho, who is a rising star in the compositional world. And we're going to perform at Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra at the end of May. So this is a piece that hopefully he'll complete shortly. He's been sending it to me in parts, you know, so we still have a few months to work on that.
And the piece that you mentioned earlier, we're going to listen to that at the end of Alaska Live to start out afternoon concert today, because it's an amazing work where you are the soloist with a symphony, and it was written for that. It's not something that's arranged like you played just an excerpt from Vivaldi's Winter Four Seasons.
Yes.
But this piece, on the other hand, was actually written with steel pan in mind.
Correct, correct. And that's something that I try to champion. You know, I'm a big advocate for original steel pan music because it's great to play transcriptions and you really warm people's hearts when you play something that's familiar to them. But because these pieces were not specifically composed for the steel pan, there's certain limitations at times, you know. So it's great to have original music for the instrument as well.
Well, and it's great too because if you already have people that love that symphony orchestra and have a regular habit of going, you're introducing them to some new soloist that they've never heard before in a new way. And do they mic the steel pan during that, or is it loud enough that...
It depends. It depends on the context. You know, there are times when I'll just do it, you know, purely acoustically. Other times you do need that extra amplification, you know. And that sometimes when I put a mic under the instrument, that can work against me because a lot of people that are not familiar with the instrument, they really don't know what to expect. So if they can't see your hands inside the bowl of the instrument, they actually think that am I faking? Not just me, but most steel pan players either. They're faking, or many times they've asked, well, where is the, you know, recording, or where's the xylophone? You know, until they walk up on stage and I actually play for them.
I never even thought about that it looks like magic.
Yeah,
because you can't really see because, you know, you are playing in this steel pan. You're in it.
So it's actually considered to be the youngest instrument of acoustic family of instruments invented in the 20th century. These instruments came into existence in the late 1930s, early 1940s, you know.
We have not had an instrument invented in a while, and that's...
From what I've learned, the vibraphone came into existence in the 1920s. So technically, it's a bit younger than the steel pan, and it is an acoustic instrument. But in terms of family of instruments and something that's almost totally original, the steel pan is really considered to be the youngest.
Come a long way.
I think so.
Is there another piece that you can do solo here on Alaska Live?
Sure.
Okay,
I'll play a piece from Brazil. And many people may be familiar with this. This is called Tico Tico.
Yeah. This is Liam Teague here, steel panist for Alaska Live on KUAC. That was delightful, Liam. Tico played Steel Pan. So somebody has taken that and arranged that for this specific instrument, because at first it was for piano?
Tico Tico?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure. You know, it's a style of music called choro from Brazil. And so some of it is instrumental, some of it is vocal. You know, so yeah. I suppose it's gone through several incarnations.
So earlier in our discussion, you were talking about your suggestions to people who want to get good at steel pan, and you have been working with the West Valley Steel Band.
Yes.
And Cold Steel. And what are some of the things that you're passing along to them? Because I take it that they are very blessed to have you here, one of, you know, the greats in steel pan, and have you here in Fairbanks doing workshops. So what are some of the things that you've been passing along to them?
Well, in addition to the music, I like to spread the culture to them, because a lot of folks that play this instrument don't actually know about the history of the steel pan. And the pioneers of these instruments, they went through a lot of mental and physical anguish to get the instrument where it is today. In the early days of the steel pan, most folks that were associated with the instrument were frowned upon. The instrument wasn't viewed as having much potential. And in some circles, steel pan players were considered to be nuisances, you know? But they had the mental fortitude and the belief that they could do something profound with this instrument. And I'm so grateful to the pioneers of these instruments that they held firm to their beliefs, even when society at large looked down upon them and they were ostracized in many circles. So, you know, especially for a lot of young kids that are having a lot of fun on the instrument, which is great, you know,
yeah.
But they have to know where the instrument came from and the sacrifices that were made for them so that they could be in their respective high schools, universities, taking the instruments around the world.
My understanding that drums were taken away. They were confiscated, and you know, a whole form of music was taken away, and that's where, you know, it was necessity that brought about the invention, right?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's the age-old story, you know. Trinidad was a colony of Britain from 1797 until 1962, when we gained independence. And during that period, the British basically tried to suppress anything that was culturally indigenous to us. And when people want to express themselves, they'll find a way to do so. So at one point, the playing of drums were banned. Trinidadians turned to the tambu-bambu, which were bamboo rods of various lengths and sizes, and they played those. Eventually, they turned to anything metallic that they could find, be it garbage cans, paint tins, containers that you use for, you know, putting biscuits or crackers in. And then there are many theories behind how the first melodic steel pan came into existence. Nobody's quite sure, but one theory is that by constantly playing these metallic objects during carnival time in Trinidad, you'd start to hear different deviations in the notes. You'd start to hear new notes being formed. And the young people of Trinidad, because the pioneers of these instruments were predominantly teenagers or young men in their early 20s, you know, they said, wait a minute, maybe we've hit upon something. And they kept experimenting and experimenting. Eventually moved on to the 55-gallon oil drum as the main raw material for making these instruments. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah. So by trying to take away music, a whole new birth of a different kind of music was born.
That's right. Out of something bad came something good. So.
And that's a triumphant story. I like that a lot.
For sure.
And the energy in the music that you are the director of the Steel Pan Program at Northern Illinois University.
That's correct.
And it's the only place in the United States where you can get a master's degree of the steel pan.
That's correct, yes.
And I watched a YouTube video of your students in the steel pan band, the steel band, and they look like they're having the time of their lives. Yet they are playing with such precision that it must take a lot of focus and concentration, but yet they have this energy.
Yes.
They're dancing,
yeah.
They're playing, and it's really incredible to watch and hear.
Honestly, the steel pan is one of the most infectious instruments in the world. I was speaking to some of the members of Cold Steel. Many of them are retired folks, and I asked them, you know, why do you love this instrument so much? And some of them said, well, you know, it just makes you feel so good. And also, it's an instrument where early on, you don't necessarily need to have any sort of great technique to be able to execute simple pieces. Obviously, as they get more difficult, you have to spend the time.
It's a bit like piano in that way.
Probably more simple than the piano.
Oh, yeah.
In that you don't have to worry about the bass line and the treble line playing simultaneously, you know. But over time, of course, it becomes more difficult. And, you know, at NIU, because we have such a high concentration of students that hail from the Caribbean, they sort of infect the non-Caribbean students with their, you know, passion and enthusiasm. And, you know, for many of the American students that are there, at first they're very quiet and reserved, you know, they're kind of scared to dance. And by the end of the semester, you swear that they were born in Port of Spain or San Fernando in Trinidad, you know. And I love to see that, and I love to see how they all come together.
You brought a recording from NIU and of the steel band.
Yes.
Should we listen to a cut from that?
That would be great.
Okay. The one I loved that I saw on YouTube, and I had to watch a couple times because your students are, like you said, they just are so energetic. It's the pan in A minor, and you arranged this.
Yes.
This is the NIU Steel Band from their recording Dangerous.
Thank you.
Teague directing the Northern Illinois University Steel Band, the recording of that. Wow. And something I remember, Liam, from when I had the West Valley Steel Band on was that there's a lot of steel pan on stage, and they also have drummers.
Yes.
With, you know, the drum set and maybe some congas and some
break drums as well.
Yes. Yeah. And is that something that came from Trinidad as well? Because when I was watching the YouTube videos of some competition and stuff, there were all kind of drummers in back too.
Yeah, we usually refer to the percussion section in the steel band as the engine room.
Yes.
So, and again, Trinidadians being very resourceful people, and almost anything that they could find, they used as a musical instrument. So you'll notice several brake drums from cars are being played, you know. And
you see the brake drums as a drum.
Correct.
Clever.
Yeah. And I must mention that, you know, although I'm the head of steel band studies at NIU, I co-direct the steel band with one of the living legends in the steel band world, a gentleman named Cliff Alexis, who was there almost from the heyday of the instrument, you know, and he's considered to be one of the greatest steel band builders, tuners, performers, arrangers, composers, a true Renaissance man, you know. And in addition to that, he, you know, more importantly, I think he's my best friend in the world, you know. So having him there to really, at first he was my teacher, I still consider him to be my teacher, but also to educate me about the history of the instrument has given me a deeper appreciation for it. And this is why I really try to represent the steel pan and by extension Trinidad to be the best way possible.
And that's what you take on tour with you too. You take that education part with you of the historical knowledge and how to play, and you know that there's such a rich tradition in it, but it's only been around, like you said, since the
1940s. You know, it's very interesting too. Early on in the interview, you mentioned how infectious the instrument is, and but obviously it's a lot of hard work. And years ago, the steel band, NIU steel band, was performing at a concert, and a young lady came up and said to us, "You know, you guys look like you're having serious fun." And we sort of took on that mantra, because that's actually what we're doing. It's a lot of hard work.
Serious fun.
But it's serious fun, you know.
I remember the first time I ever witnessed, I knew them as steel drums, because we were at the World, I was a kid, and I was with my family at the World's Fair. Uh-huh. And all of a sudden, we came across the Trinidad exhibit, and they always had the steel players out there. And I just remember going, wow, it looks like they've made these amazing instruments out of what, to me as a kid, looked kind of like metal trash cans.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up in Kansas, that really had not occurred to us there yet.
Yeah, exactly. There's some people that advocate that the steel pan is actually the best example of recycling in the world.
Indeed. Because, you know, they, you said they used old oil drums.
Yes, 55-gallon oil drums.
55-gallon oil drums, And do they replace the tops, or do they just make the pound the tops until they're concave?
That's correct. They pound them until they're concave, and depending on the instrument, the range of the instrument, you sink it to a particular depth. You know, with the tenor pans, you sink them quite deep so you can fit as many notes as possible into them. The bass is not as deep because you can maybe get maybe 3 to 4 notes in one drum, hence the reason you need multiple drums for an entire chromatic scale.
Right. And as far as you're talking about tuning these, and tuning them has to do with where you put the notes and how far you've put them into the pan.
Yeah. If you see a steel pan, you'll see different egg note shapes or oval shapes. And these instruments are all tuned with hammers. And the basic principle is by striking different places on the note, it either raises or lowers the note. And, you know, as a youngster growing up, when I saw the tuners do it, you know, for me, it wasn't a big deal. They just looked like it was, you know, no rhyme or reason to it. They were just pounding until we got a sound. But it's quite scientific. And we consider a lot of steel pan tuners to be grassroots scientists.
It's all about the physics.
It is. It is. And there certainly is some trial and error to it, but a lot of it is based on science. And I remember trying to learn how to do it several summers ago. And it took me upwards of 2 hours just to get one harmonic on one note. And I said, you know what? I admire this. I love it. But I'll leave this to the Cliff Alexises of the world. You know?
Do you find that the people that are just learning will take a Sharpie and write down what note it is on what part? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, for sure. Because unlike, say, the piano, which is laid out in half steps, C, C sharp, D, D sharp, etc., most steel pans are not, well, actually none of them are laid out that way, because they were laid out that way, the notes would clash, you know, when you have half steps next to each other. So some of them are laid out in intervals of fourths and fifths. Some of them are whole tone scales. My instrument is in thirds and fourths, you know, so.
Do you have yours marked with Sharpie?
Not for today's performance.
Okay. We're on radio, so
yes, nobody will know.
Yeah. Can you do another solo piece here, Liam?
Sure.
Okay.
No problem.
Great.
I'll play a composition. This I want to dedicate to my mom. She passed away on January 17th. And this is a composition of her favorite composer, me. It's called Raindrops.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
And the rainstorm concludes there. Liam Teague, you said that was a composition of your own.
Yes, called, I did it when I was about 15 years old.
And your mother really, she loved that tune, huh? I can see why.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you.
That really shows the versatility of the instrument, too. Here on Alaska Live, you've played a Paganini piece. You've played a traditional one from Lord Kirchner, one of the innovators for composition for steel pan. And you've played one of your own pieces, and they've all been very different from each other.
Yes, thank you.
And that just shows the versatility of this. What looks on the outside to be a simple instrument,
yes.
But when you exhibited the different notes, obviously it's not a simple instrument.
Yeah, I like to think about it as profundity and simplicity, you know?
Yeah. You brought in one of the CDs that you did with Robert Chappell. Tell mm-hmm. me about this duo.
Yeah, Robert Chappell, he's a former professor at Northern Illinois University, and he was one of my first teachers. And he's one of these very versatile musicians, plays everything but the kitchen sink, you know? And I learned so much from him, and many years ago we decided to form a duo, and we compose a lot of original music which highlights the steel pan in different musical contexts and with different musical instruments. So he plays classical and jazz piano, marimba, vibraphone, Indian tabla, mm-hmm. and we've been able to incorporate the steel pan with those various instruments.
The first one I have queued up that I want to just sample a little bit, it's called a Calypso Sonata. Sounds like that might be a mashup of some classical and calypso music.
Correct. Calypso Sonata. So it's actually in sonata form, which, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn wrote in. But it's set to calypso groove.
All right, let's hear from the recording from Liam Teague and Robert Chappell.
Sure.
You can hear how that sonata comes through mm-hmm. in the calypso music in that piece. Mm-hmm. Wanted to play one other sample from this CD that actually features the duet of you and Robert Chappell. Tell us about this piece called Dogla.
Yes, so Dogla in Trinidad, we usually refer to people of sort of mixed ancestry, usually Indian and Afro-Trinidadians, as Doglas. This piece was composed for my son, Jaden, who was actually born in Panama. My wife mm-hmm. is from Panama, and my wife, Lorena, and Jaden lived there for about 3 years before they moved up to the USA. So it's dedicated to him.
Great.
Thank you.
fun piece. You can hear the mix of, you know, it all mixing in like a great stew right there.
Yeah. For sure.
And there was a kid at the beginning. Was that your son?
Yeah, he was just a baby. And he was saying, Papa, Papa. So we wanted to get that on the recording.
Good job. And how old is he these days?
He's 7 years old, going on 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know how that goes.
Can you lower the steel pan enough so he can start learning?
Yeah, he just started maybe about 2 months ago, and he's doing really well, you know. I'm just giving him like 10-minute lessons every day, trying not to force it.
Sure.
It's something he wants to do.
Do kids in Trinidad, do they start playing the steel pan very early in life?
Many of them, yeah. You can go to the pan yards, which is where many steel pan players gather, and you see these young kids. Most of them, they don't know how to read music, but they learn by ear or by rote, you know, imitating hand patterns sometimes. And some of them are 6, 7 years old, you know, and it's great because it's a wonderful musical education because they start learning syncopation from very early, you know, and they don't know they're learning how to syncopate. It's just something that comes natural. So it's a wonderful musical education for them.
And they're already dancing as they're playing. They're already
as soon
doing
as they
that.
Come out of the womb, I think. It's in our DNA, you know.
When I was watching, I don't know what group it was. Maybe it was called Mangrove, or maybe it was the name of the song. I'm not quite sure. But that it was just a sea of musicians playing steel pan music, and they were all dancing.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. And the band leader is also, it's more like the jazz band leader, it looks like, rather than the conductor of a symphony.
Mm-hmm.
They're dancing and they're pointing and they've got the rhythm.
Yeah, yeah. So it was probably a steel band you heard for the Panorama competition. And a lot of arrangers over the past few years have elected to go in front of the bands so they can not only dance, but also point out specific spots in the music to the adjudicators that they really want them to pay attention to.
Uh-huh.
And some people tend to go a little overboard with it, you know. I don't know. But it's something that I actually don't do. I just play. I don't go in front of the band.
Okay, yeah. So when you are the band leader, you are one of the players.
One of the players,
yeah. Oh, okay.
I just don't have the theatrics down as yet. I'm working on it.
And so as the band leader, while you're playing, do you cue the band a bit as you're playing, though?
Not really, because for me, by that time, if they don't know the music, well, they'll never know it. You know?
It's been practiced and practiced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is great. We do have Ray Funk has come in, and he's not only the host of KUAC's Funk Roots for the last going almost on 4 decades now of Funk Roots. That's just amazing. But Ray, you are the foremost expert of music from Trinidad and Calypso music. I'm sorry, I have to say that.
I don't know about that, but I have great joy in going down to Trinidad when it's 40 or 50 below here in carnival time. And I started with a love of Calypso, and then I've been going to hear Pan more and more, and I've been writing about Pan, and I've my family's from Chicago, so whenever I used to go visit my parents before they passed away, they lived about 40 minutes from where Liam and Cliff have their incredible steel band at NIU, and I used to go by every time I was home to see them perform. In fact, I was known to arrange trips home when they were doing their spring concert. One of the amazing things about the NIU Steel Band program is that they webcast it, so anybody can watch their spring and fall concerts. And they have somebody in a booth handling half a dozen cameras. And there are these wonderful webcasts of each concert. And
nice.
This year you've got a special program with a wind ensemble.
Yes, we're collaborating with the NIU Wind Ensemble. One of our Trinidadian graduate students, he did an adaptation of Jupiter from Gustav Holst's The Planet. So we're going to do that piece with them, in addition to a steel pan concerto that was written for me by Kevin Bobo, a wonderful virtuoso marimbist and great composer. So we're going to collaborate with that as well.
The beauty of the World Wide Web.
Yes. Yeah, and that's on when it's on Sunday afternoon.
April 26th at 3 p.m.
Central. 3 p.m. Central. Yeah. So it's noon here, and there you can just find it by the NIU Music Department web, and it comes over really well, and it's incredibly well broadcast, where you can see everybody and the soloists, and Liam's the one who really is out there commissioning pieces to take the music places it's never gone, besides going down and arranging one of the greatest. Oh, and when Liam mentioned that with Silver Stars, he doesn't stand in front. Silver Stars happens to have a wild man who's nicknamed Bravo, who is the conductor, but it's more of a performance thing. He leaps into the air. He jumps across the stage.
Oh, how fun.
So it's very fun to be down in Trinidad and hear the steel bands. But I want to encourage anyone who can to come out tomorrow to West Valley High at 3 o'clock Alaska time and get to see Cold Steel, which evolved out of the University of Alaska, Fairbanks Steel Band, into a community group that performs all the time. And West Valley, which has had a steel band for many years.
They've been Alaska Live.
Yes, yeah. And you get a chance to hear both of them. And they've been working this week with Liam Teague, who really is, as you can hear, one of the fastest pianists in the West. And just an amazing performer who really is, more than anyone else, trying to take the instrument into places it's not gone before. And I'm especially excited. I don't think I can get there, but Andy Akio, who's a wonderful composer that I've met, the fact that he's, for the first time, I mean, he just had a piece for the New York Symphony, but he grew up and started playing on pan. So when he composes, unlike the people who do compositions from piano, he really works it out from pan, and this is his first ever concerto, and he's picked the best to be the soloist, and this is our National Symphony. It's going to be at the Kennedy Center right at the end of May, so it's pretty special, although Liam's practicing now on what he's gotten. It's just being finished up. It's very exciting.
Ray's being too kind. I'm not the best, but I'm certainly happy that Andy chose me, because he can actually play the piece himself. He's that good, so I'm so grateful that he made the exception for me.
Will you play one more finale here for us here on Alaska Live? Thank you, Liam.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That was beautiful, Liam. Thank you so much for being my guest here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And thanks to KUAC intern Brady Gross and to Funk Roots host Ray Funk. You can hear more from Liam T and West Valley Steel Band and Cold Steel tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the West Valley Performing Arts Center. For KUAC's Alaska Live, I'm Lori Neufeld. You can find archive versions of Alaska Live at our website, kuac.org.